next year for more Final Draft. Till then, happy reading.
Good morning and welcome to the final Vulture's Nest for 2019. I'm your host Sean Morahan. During the year here in the Vulture's Nest, each week we have chosen a few of the more unusual stories from the week's news and we've pulled them apart for your entertainment. Today being our last show for the year, we are going to review some of those stories that we've covered for you during 2019. During the year we've had a variety of guests as well, and thank you to all of our guests in the Nest, some of whom we're going to specifically mention today as we review some of those stories that they've covered with us. In January, we talked about an unusual recruitment campaign undertaken by one of the UK's biggest employers. In a time when many Western countries have low youth employment and more young people are only employed part-time or casual in the gig economy, one major employer in England took a very interesting approach to recruitment. In their recruitment ads, they identified what are seen by many employers as weaknesses of young workers and called them strengths. The British Army gave credit to young people for the very behaviours they were probably criticised for. The ads that were in this campaign from the British Army included messages like, "Binge gamers, your army needs you and your drive." "Me, me, me, millennials, your army needs you and your self-belief." "Selfie addicts, your army needs you and your confidence." "Snowflakes, your army needs you and your compassion." With my guests on the program that day, Peter and David, we reviewed one of the TV ads that accompanied the campaign. The focus character of the ad was a woman of presumably recent African heritage. We made the distinction because we are all of African heritage. But in the ad, the woman was doing the grunt work at a supermarket, retrieving trolleys, sweeping. While some of her notably white co-workers weren't doing any work, they ostracised her and called her useless behind her back, yelled things at her like, "Jesus, hurry up," and "Come on, chop, chop." Her supermarket life then became interspersed with images that the army may have called glamour footage. It included things like a first-person view of riding in a helicopter with a voiceover saying, "Looks like a perfectionist to me," a platoon of soldiers patrolling a smoking combat zone, a woman soldier distributing food to people in what is made to look possibly like Afghanistan or Iraq, a voiceover saying the word resilience, two soldiers deploying a spy drone, a special operations team getting into a house, looking how the capture of Osama bin Laden had been described in the news. Soldiers ordering people to safety in a street of burning cars. And a sniper lining up a kill saying, "Patience, always welcome." It finished with the visual tagline, "Army, be your best." So I asked Peter and David that day what they thought of the ad. We did observe together that the woman in the ad was evidently a victim of some horrible racism, and an army career was bizarrely implied to be the solution to get away from that racism. The ad seemed to say, "Let's solve racism by sending you overseas to kill foreigners." And maybe it's targeted not necessarily at the woman, but at her support group, family and friends who, if she asks what about a career in the army, will now think that she's better off in the army away from all that nasty workplace bullying. Later in January, I was joined by Sydney comedian Peter Green to talk about another story, the Golden Globes. We talked about the red carpet at the Golden Globes Awards and how they'd made the news for an unusual reason. Whether you've been to one or not, I think we all like the idea of putting on a nice frock and our best lipstick and strutting our stuff. But enough about the footy show, let's get back to that red carpet story. The Golden Globes red carpet made the news in January, especially because it was photobombed by mock waiters holding strategically placed products, those products being champagne and a bottled water. They photobombed it so heavily it maybe could have even been called a carpet bombing. We discussed the merits and demerits of product placements, and we questioned whether product placement succeeded in making awards nights interesting enough to watch. I think our conclusion was that they didn't. We also hypothesised that if we had our choice of Red Carpet Awards to photobomb, what would be the event most likely? So we discussed, would it be the Oscars, the Logies, the Dally M Awards, the Brownlow Medal, Fashion Awards, the Alan Border Medal Night, Helpman Awards, or perhaps some other awards. Another story that we discussed during the year had to do with mistaken identity. So in late January, I reported on a case of mistaken identity, and I started the story by relating my own incident of mistaken identity. As recently as the night before, I'd organised a comedy show. And as I often do, I'd placed myself as the reserve comedian, ready to perform in case anyone else was a no-show. I tend to work with very reliable comedians, so someone not turning up is a very rare occurrence. I wouldn't say it's standard practice in the industry to have a substitute ready, but that's what happens when someone with a couple of decades working in corporate risk management gets into running comedy shows. And that night before our Vulture's Nest show, through a series of accidents, one comedian couldn't make it to the show, so I ended up having to perform. For that show, there was a printed program with the pictures and profiles of all the performing comedians. And before I go any further, I should probably let you know that, one, I'm 6'8", two, I'm bald, and three, my picture and bio were not in the printed program. I performed second last that night in a lineup of seven comedians. And although I know not everyone reads the program, I'm sure I had some people in the audience trying to work out if I was the 30-something blonde woman comedian who plays the ukulele, or whether I was the Jewish New York comedian in his 60s. Notably, perhaps, no one asked my autograph after the show. But the show did go well, thank you for asking. My other significant case of mistaken identity was walking down the street of an Australian country town in the 1990s. I think it was Young. Hey, I think we both were. So I was walking through Young and a teenager approached me and asked, "Aren't you Jason Donovan?" And I assured him that I wasn't. But he refused to believe. "No, mate, you are definitely Jason Donovan." So years later it occurred to me that it probably wasn't a compliment, whether it was intended as one or not. Although mistaken identity stories appear in the news all the time, incompetent people being mistaken for political leaders and captains of industry, the notable report of mistaken identity that we talked about in that particular episode of The Vulture's Nest was a 47-year-old British woman named Dee Ford. Dee had been mistaken on Twitter for an American footballer with the same name. And I know what you're probably thinking, how could anybody make a mistake on Twitter? But go with me on this. Importantly for the story, the footballer Dee Ford plays for the Kansas City Chiefs, who during that week lost a game in extra time after tying the scores with the New England Patriots at full time. It's alleged by people with a greater interest in these things than me that the footballer Dee Ford made a mistake that cost his team the game. And the British woman Dee Ford said she had received some vile messages over the years filled with expletives and insults, and that seemed to get particularly harsh after the latest defeat that week. She said, "Some say things like, 'I hope your life is ruined.' One even said it was my fault he couldn't afford to feed his children because he lost his money betting on the game that the Chiefs didn't win." Dee Ford, the British woman, also said, "I know the comments aren't actually directed at me, but I do wonder why these people think it's okay to send these awful messages to anybody." She updated her profile years ago to make it clear that she is not the footballer, but she said every match still brings a relentless stream of comments. Perhaps she's overestimating the intelligence of American football fans. Some of the comments included, "You've ruined my whole year, Dee Ford. I hope your ugly wife in your profile picture leaves you." Dee replied, "I'll give you a minute to check my timeline." That particular commenter then replied, "Wait, you're not the football player? I'm sorry, I have diabetes. I must have gotten the names mixed up. I'm so sorry." Frowny face emoji. Dee Ford, the one who has never yet cost an American NFL team a chance at playing in the Super Bowl. I hope you're impressed there with my thoroughly researched American football-y references. That Dee Ford, she has been getting his attention since the university sports official accidentally tagged her in a tweet back in 2014. Her Twitter account leapt from 20 up to 5,000 followers after that particular instance. 5,000 followers seems like a small number of followers for a prominent American footballer, but I don't want you arguing with me that maybe only the dumb ones follow her, because I think we both know where that argument will lead. With all the attention that she was getting, Dee, the British woman, chose to learn more about the game, and she now follows the game. She even chose a team to follow, which is not the Kansas City Chiefs. And please don't pretend that you are curious to know which team she follows, because let's face it, it's American football. If I even made a team up, would you really know the difference? Well, let's try an experiment. It was one of these three teams: the Roswell Aliens, the Auburn Tigers, the Beverly Hillbillies. Have a guess. And if I don't get distracted by something mildly distracting in the next 5 minutes or so, I'll give you the answer a little bit later in the program. But no promises. And if you're not happy with this cruel game and you want to call the station and complain, be sure to get my name right. It's Jason Donovan. Another story that I wanted to share for you that we had covered earlier in the year from Twitter was about Patton Oswalt. Patton Oswalt is an American comedian. He replied on Twitter to some guy called Donald Trump. This Trump fellow had tweeted a short pity message: build a wall and crime will fall. Oswalt replied to this Trump fellow by tweeting a fairly rude poem of his own, which I won't read on air because I don't want to do any more damage to Jason Donovan's reputation. If you only just tuned in and you don't get the Jason Donovan reference, then you can take that as a powerful reminder of the importance of tuning in from 10:30 a.m. on a Saturday. Actually, no, hang on. If you tune in at 10:30, you'll miss Andrew Popel at 10 o'clock. So you can take that as a powerful reminder of tuning in from 10 a.m. on a Saturday to 2SER 107.3. Actually, no, hang on. If you tune in at 10, you'll also miss Jess on Weekend Breakfast at 7. So you can take that as a powerful reminder of the importance of tuning in from 7 a.m. on a Saturday, so you get the full build-up to my jokes about Jason Donovan. And I, Jason Donovan, apologise if you have been listening since 7 a.m. I apologise that I had to take time out of your radio listening enjoyment to explain all of this to the latecomers. Anyway, back to Patton Oswalt. Patton Oswalt replied to a Twitter... replied on Twitter to a Trump poem with a poem of his own. A Trump follower named Michael Beattie then tweeted some hateful nonsense at Patton Oswalt. And if you hadn't been on Twitter, this is how it works. You're not really missing anything except this story, which you probably wouldn't have found on Twitter because that's not how Twitter works. But it appears that Patton Oswalt did some research about his attacker, presumably so he could reply with a zinger put down, because that is how Twitter works. But when he looked a bit more into Michael Beattie online, he found that Michael was a 64-year-old Vietnam veteran who was having trouble paying his medical bills and had set up a GoFundMe page with a target of $5,000 to try and pay his medical expenses. When Oswalt found this out, he asked his followers to donate to Beattie's GoFundMe page. His message was, "Oh man, this dude just attacked me on Twitter, and I joked back, but then I looked at his timeline and he's in a lot of trouble health-wise. I'd be pissed off too." He's been dealt some expletive deleted cards. Let's deal him some good ones. Click and donate, just like I'm about to. The morning that we reported that story, Michael Beattie's GoFundMe was already at $36,364. And just checking it again this morning, it's now at $47,785. Michael Beattie replied to Patton Oswalt publicly. He said, "Patton, you have humbled me to the point where I can barely compose my words. You've caused me to take pause and reflect on how harmful words from my mouth could result in such an outpouring. Thank you for this, and I will pass this on to my cousin who needs help, a cascade." So if there was one rule that we could take out of this story for having a good life, it's be nice to each other. And if there were two things that we could take out of this story for having a good life, it's be nice to each other and listen to The Vulture's Nest, starting with our opening act, Jess Clayman, on Weekend Breakfast on Saturdays from 7 a.m. And if there are three things that we could take from this story for having a good life, it's 1, be nice to each other; 2, listen to The Vulture's Nest, starting with our opening act, Jess Clayman, on Weekend Breakfast on Saturdays from 7 a.m. and 3, be mean to people on Twitter until they give you lots of money. And the answer to our guessing game earlier in the program, the correct answer was the Auburn Tigers. But if there were teams called the Roswell Aliens or the Beverly Hillbillies, I'd probably start following them. Just saying. American football executives, if you're listening and looking for your next expansion market. Anyway, here at 2SER, we are all about stories, ideas and music. Let's deliver on our music promise right now. Here's a great track called Led Me Down by Liz Martin. You're on to SER 107.3.
Let me down by the river where salty flesh bled to an ocean dragging me. There was nothing but heading down, down. Troubled roots clawed at perfection, dragging me till there was nothing but heading down, down, down. I wonder what you'd say, well, here I am. I wonder why you pray when they don't understand.
That was Liz Martin with Led Me Down. If you want to see a little bit more of what Liz Martin's up to, you can go to her website, lizmartin.com.au. She has some live gigs in Sydney coming up in the new year. You are on to SER 107.3 and you are listening to The Vulture's Nest, an irreverent weekly review of the week's news and culture. Today, in our last program for 2019, we are reviewing some of the stories that we've covered this year. I'm your host, Sean Morahan. In one program earlier in the year, Aaron Rooney, John Knowles and David Polterak all joined me in the studio and we looked at a story that we called Fashion Crime or Fashion Misdemeanor. A Sydney magistrate gave a dressing down to an economically clad defendant in a Sydney court, and surely a dressing down was the last thing that she needed. Chilean national Barbara Diana Vasconcello Cardenas, who was 37 years old, appeared in Sutherland local court on charges of drink driving. She wore some frayed and fairly high-cut denim cut-off shorts to court. The magistrate asked the defendant if she had a jumper to tie around her waist to cover herself up. "It is completely inappropriate to wear cut-off denim shorts up to your thighs in court," Judge Carney told Cardenas through a Spanish interpreter, according to the Daily Telegraph. I'm very tolerant to all types of attire, but this is beach attire what you're wearing. This is a court. Do you appreciate what I've said? She asked if Cardenas had a jumper she could tie around her waist. She did not, but the sentencing continued regardless. Cardenas pleaded guilty to drink driving, was fined $400, disqualified from driving for 3 months, and ordered to hold an interlock licence for 12 months following the disqualification. In exploring that story, we asked, are we all equal under the law? To what degree do you think your appearance affects your chances of justice and or a desirable outcome in court? We asked all our guests that day if they'd been to court, and if so, how did they dress? The magistrate's criticism had been called sexist and slut-shaming. We discussed whether we thought that was the case. It had been alleged as well that male defendants appear in court in shorts or thongs and aren't criticised, or perhaps they are criticised, but it's not considered newsworthy. Some magistrates and barristers wear antiquated costume for court. Is this considered to be appropriate and fair? We asked as well if you could guess the gender of the magistrate, and or if you knew the gender of the magistrate, and would that make any difference to the magistrate's opinion? In the interests of justice, we also asked, should you be made to wear to court what you were wearing at the time of the alleged offence? A little bit later in the year, I was joined by my guest Peter Gleeson for another instalment of Vulture's Nest, and we talked about entrepreneurship. Yes, the news in the story had been around for 20 years, but we discovered it that week because it only made the mainstream news earlier this year in reports on the World Economic Forum website. The headline of that article on the World Economic Forum website, Sweden gives all employees time off to be entrepreneurs. The Right to Leave to Conduct a Business Operation Act guarantees that employees have the right to take a leave of absence of up to 6 months to start their own company in Sweden. One of the conditions is that the business that they start cannot be a competitor with their current employer. The leave can be taken once per employer, and you must have been an employee for at least 6 months before taking the leave. Swedish employers are required to give you a 6 month unpaid leave if you want then to try and start your own business. We discussed this story and we asked if we would take this leave if we were employed in Sweden, if this was a disincentive for employers. We also asked if you were working on your own startup, what would you change? What would change for you in your life and how would it change? We asked generally, what is the appeal of starting your own business? And is it fair to existing businesses to offer this leave as an incentive for others to leave and take 6 months and try and start their own businesses? Another regular guest Nest this year, David Polterak, he joined me in another instalment of the Nest this year. And we talked about Kim Jong-un travelling 60 hours by train for his annual game of rock, paper, scissors with the President of the United States. This time it was in Hanoi, Vietnam. And from my point of view, at least, there seemed to be more media attention on his playing strategy for rock, paper, scissors than there was on his unusual method for getting his ass to Vietnam. Some reports said he was replicating his grandfather's trips to Vietnam in 1958 and 1964 to reinforce his legitimacy as a successor in the Kim regime. Others said it was a name-dropping exercise so that when he met his opponent, Kim Jong-un could psych him out a little bit by saying, "Yeah, I was just discussing the best episodes of Scooby-Doo with my old China. And by me old China, I mean the People's Republic. Oh, did I mention China gave my train a green light through the entire country to get here?" Yet others say that Kim Jong-un didn't fly in order to avoid the inevitable comparison at the Hanoi Airport urinal. It's a little known fact that the urinal at Hanoi Airport has a window overlooking the tarmac, so you can easily see who has the bigger jet parked out there. Personally, I suspect that Kim Jong-un chose a 60-hour train trip so that the pain of having to meet with Donald Trump would be dulled by comparison. Another long-time Nest guest joined me in another instalment this year, Terina Taite. T is a regular guest. She joined me in one instalment of the Vulture's Nest to talk about songs that get stuck in your head. Have you ever had a tune stuck in your head that you cannot get out of your head? Worse, have you ever had a tune that you really dislike stuck in your head? Well, the week that we reported on that story, that had happened to me. I was in a supermarket and a song called Under the Water by Australian singer Meryl Bainbridge was playing. And it was stuck in my head for about 4 days when we finally got to our Saturday to talk about it on the Vulture's Nest. And having that fresh in my head, I also introduced a story to discuss with T, which was a Boston psychiatrist, Dr. Stephen Schlossman. He got to breaking point with the hold music for the CVS pharmacy chain in the United States. So Dr. Schlossman wrote a letter to a radio station, WBUR, addressed to their health program and pleading for the music to change. The radio station followed up with the pharmacy, and they subsequently relented and said that they had planned to change the music. We talk generally about on-hold music and the companies who play music interspersed with the message, your call is important to us. T and I identify that there's probably a business opportunity there, and on air that day, we decided we record a song called Your Call is Important to Us. I played the kazoo and T did the vocals, so we decided we could always mix in the symphony orchestra backing stuff later. That's just some of the mischief we've got up to on Vulture's Nest this year. You are on 2SER 107.3. It's the last Vulture's Nest for the year. I'm Sean Morahan, and today I'm just reviewing some of the stories that we've covered with you in the Vulture's Nest in 2019. In April, my guest Peter Gleeson and I discussed that the BBC had reported on a man who spent a year talking to himself, but did so while thinking he was talking to other people. He did this on a website called Reddit, which was the 18th most visited site in the world last year. I'm guessing it's only slightly behind the 2SER website, 2SER.com. Reddit is an American social news aggregation web content rating and discussion website. My guest that day, Peter Gleeson, is a user and fairly familiar with Reddit, so he was a great guest to have to discuss this story. Registered members on the site submit content such as links, text posts, images, and they are then voted up or down by the other members of the site. So it's sort of like a modern version of show and tell at school, but without the subsequent playground bullying at recess. Reddit user 34-year-old Andy Bowen had kept posting when faced with silence for an entire year, only to find out that he'd been mistakenly shadow banned the entire time. So during the year, although he could post and comment on Reddit, nobody could see his contributions. Andy said that for a long time he didn't understand why people weren't commenting on his posts, and he highlighted one in particular that he was very disappointed that nobody saw at the time. There were a couple of posts on the diabetes forum, he said, where people had asked questions and I had the answers. There's one specific one where someone was putting out a cry for help. Mine was one of only two responses. It's gone now, they obviously never saw my response, and I don't know, you never know what's happening to the person behind it. I wonder how would my contribution have changed them during that time. This is our final instalment of the Vulture's Nest on 2SER for 2019. I'd like to take this opportunity to thank all of our listeners for joining us on Saturday mornings here at 10:30 on the Vulture's Nest. We look forward to welcoming you back in 2020 for more Vulture's Nest mischief. Thank you to all of the guests on the Nest this year. We are going to finish up the show now with a track. We're going to listen to the S-Bends, and this is Tourist Attraction. You are on 2SER 107.3, Stories, Ideas, Music.